G'day, welcome to the show. It's Better Than Yesterday. I'm Oshie Ginsberg. We're here to make it better every episode since 2013, and I am grateful to be here with you today. I've been making the show for over 10 years, and I love doing it because I love the lessons that I learn making this show, and I'm happy to be sharing today and over the past couple of weeks some of the biggest lessons that I got out of 2023. Couldn't make this show without your support. I love making this podcast. I love that it is one of the ways that I pay a mortgage and put food in the fridge and provide for my family. And I also love that it's a great way to improve the way that I perceive the world around me, to have conversations with the people that sometimes challenge my views, and me being open to having my views challenged because I trust this person, they're in my home, and, you know, let's have a chat here. I might not agree on the ideological solution you have to this problem, but we both see a problem, so let's talk about it. I love having those kind of conversations. I also love that I get to connect with you and connect to my guests, and I just really like learning. I really do. I didn't like it at school, but I really like it. I really like doing it this way. If they only had high school, the podcast, I would have fucking nailed it. But I love learning about new things in this way, because learning has been shown, you know, not just that. Learning has been shown to, you know, you live longer, you're kind of more, you're sharper for longer in your life. But I also get a great amount of joy in the pursuit of mastery. I really like it. And I try to get as good as I can at whatever it is that I'm doing. Like, I really, honestly, coiling the charging cable for the Nissan Leaf that is in our driveway, the electric vehicle, has got a heavy cable. And if you roll it wrong, it just plops straight off the hook. But I'm trying to get to a point where I can just go, like when I was a roadie, and just hang a heavy cable so it hangs perfectly on the driveway wall. I'm trying to achieve mastery in rolling up the Christmas lights I probably should have pulled out of the frangipani about a week and a half ago. I'm trying to achieve mastery every day, putting in my contact lens with less and less fuss each day, just trying to get it better every day. I really derive a lot of joy out of getting things like that right. But I'm also interested in, you know, what is it I'm not doing as well as I can for the people around me, the way I interact with people, the way I interpret conversations, or the way that I read a situation. I'm trying to get better and better at being me every day for myself and for the people that I care about and the people that care about me. And some of the biggest lessons I got this year came out of this room that I'm sitting in right now, connecting with people, doing a podcast right here. And from the lessons that I learned, I want to share some of them with you. And boy, oh boy, I've been doing this show a long time. There's over 500 interviews that I've done. And this chat with Tom Carroll is extraordinary. The lessons that have come out of the font of wisdom that is Tom Carroll are just profound. What Tom has got to say about addiction, about trauma and recovery, are just extraordinary. The next hour is going to change your life, because when you think of someone who's addicted to methamphetamines, meth in the US, it's known as ICE in Australia. It's got other names around the world. But you know what it is. If you picture what an ICE addict looks like, or a meth addict looks like, where their life is, where they live, what their job is, what their relationship with their family is like. Do they have friends? What are their friends like? What does their bed look like? What does their car look like? What's the image that comes to mind when you think about what kind of clothes they wear, the look on their face? You've probably got a pretty clear picture already, especially if you're thinking about teeth. But I'll bet you that that picture is not a very successful middle-aged man with a beautiful home near the beach, a man who is a father of three daughters. I'll bet that you did not picture Australian surfing legend Tom Carroll. But at one point, that is exactly what Tom Carroll's life had become. In the world of professional surfing, Tom Carroll is an absolute legend. Through the 80s and through the 90s, he just dominated the world circuit, becoming the first surfer to sign a multi-million dollar contract before any of those guys. In 83 and 84, back to back, he achieved the pinnacle of his sport, became world champion two in a row. But it's what Tom has achieved out of the water, which is possibly even more incredible. And this is a guy that surfs waves bigger than your and my house next to each other, 400 miles off the coast of somewhere with Ross Clark Jones. Like, the guy's a hell man. Some of the biggest waves in the world he surfed. Because in today's episode, Tom talks about how he found himself sliding down the slippery slope of addiction, and how that addiction began to take absolutely everything that he loved away from him, had him trapped in a cycle of drug abuse that he was able to see was heading towards a very grim end. Now, I'm no stranger to talking about recovery from drugs and alcohol. It's a part of my story. It's a huge reason why I started this show. because I didn't know that not drinking and not using was an option. I wanted to have conversations out there in the world which could demonstrate that there was an alternative and that help was available if you needed it. I certainly needed to hear these kind of chats when I was struggling. I'm grateful that I can be a part of bringing conversations like this out into the public eye or public ear, depending on how you're getting this episode, because it's on YouTube and it's on a podcast here. Tom Carroll is an incredibly wise man, and even if you don't have a problem with any substance, with gambling or any other kind of addiction, the wisdom that Tom has to share about untreated trauma, taking responsibility for your choices, taking responsibility for your situation, is transformative stuff. But first, look, we've got to pay the bills. So here's some ads.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss. If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even though I absolutely love surfing and I love every part of it, I love the ocean, I love the engagement it gives me and the fact that I can offer that, you know, I coach kids surfing and riding big, big, challenging waves, and they needed to get intensity, and that was a part of my condition. I don't need that anymore. It's not a part of the equation anymore.
That is surfer and author Tom Carroll. And this is Osher Ginsberg, Better Than Yesterday. G'day, welcome. This is Better Than Yesterday, making it better every episode since 2013. We're learning something new through a conversation with a person who's been there before. I'm here Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays. Mondays and Wednesdays with a guest, Fridays here with you. There's over 500 interviews on a Monday to check out, over 200 episodes on a Friday to check out, where I basically just kind of talk about what's going through my head and how I deal with the shit that I'm living with. People tell me those episodes are some of their favorites. There's lots to listen to. And I'm Osher Ginsberg. Thanks for being here. I'm a TV show host. I'm a podcaster. I'm an author. I'm a dad. I'm a stepdad. I'm a gluey contact lens wearer. Looking across the desk at my eye drops that I put in my eyeball to make my contact lens kind of not blink out, and I can't quite reach them and keep recording this. There we go. I'll do this pirate style with one eye closed. Thanks for being a part of the show. If you need me, you can find me, sendosheremail@gmail.com. That's where you can get me. And I do have an ask for you. There's a listener survey that I'm doing at the moment because I've been doing this for over 10 years and I really want to make sure from time to time, I want to make sure that I'm doing the right thing for you. So if you could take the time, it takes about 10 minutes, jump on there and tell me what you like, what you don't like, what you want more of, what you want less of. Oh my God, he's so self-righteous. We talk about addiction. Blah, blah. I don't care. Tell me. It's fascinating. I'd love to know because communication is the basis of any great relationship. And you and I have been together for a long time. So I want to be sure that I'm doing the right thing for both of us because I don't want to make something that you don't want. Yeah, but I still want to make it. you can find it in the show notes. Now, look, in case I didn't make it clear enough before, let me tell you one more time that this episode is brought to you. It's sponsored by South Pacific Private. That's a short way of saying they're paying me. Now, listen, they're not the only place that people can get help from addiction, but they're definitely one which operates with a great deal of integrity. Go where you need to go, where you can get to, wherever's near you. Just go. Know that there's help and know that it doesn't have to be the way it is for the rest of your life. This conversation that you're about to hear with Tom Carroll is absolutely one of the greats. You've probably got your favorites, but it's not often that I get a chance to speak about recovery or addiction like this in a way that is accessible, freely accessible, and something that I fucking wish I heard when I was a young man. And certainly out of the mouth of someone as legendary as Tom Carroll. It's a great chat. Hope you enjoy it. We made it.
We made it, Osha.
So happy you're here, Tom.
It's good to be here. Actually, last time you actually came to my house.
I came to your house.
Yeah.
And you have the freaking Bonsai Pipeline trophy, which is a big hat at your place. And I tried not to freak out when I saw it. It's been a minute.
It is.
That podcast was really important. That was for the Movember podcast. Mm. And I know enough to know that just because I can't see it doesn't mean it's not possible. So all I need to do is talk to people who are where I want to be, that were once where I was. And at the time, I was struggling really hard with suicidality and stuff like that. So I pitched Movember. I said, we should do a podcast about suicide prevention. They're like, great, we'll team you up with some of my ambassadors. I'm like, brilliant. But what I ended up doing then, which is kind of what I wanted to do, I started talking to survivors, suicide survivors.
Yes.
And like sitting down face to face or connecting over
a
call and being able to hear, because there was no meetings for that.
Yeah.
You know, but I knew that worked. Mm. I knew what it is to sit and have someone tell me it's going to be okay, even though you can't see it right now. Your brain is telling me there's no other way for it to work.
Mm.
It can. Just do this. Don't worry about next year. Mm. Don't worry about next month, next week. Mm-mm. Just today. Do this and come talk to me tomorrow.
Same resolution, really, isn't it? Like, if you want to resolve this, it's sort of you don't want to give all your demons a chance. So the hack is just to be now, and then you do, and just act now what you need to do.
Yeah,
and that might be nothing.
Actually, when I came to your house, I was still pretty unwell.
Mm.
It took me quite a while, but you know, it was a long hike in.
So it's good to be here and see you.
Man, I'm so
You're
glad.
Looking well.
I'm so, you know, 13 years, 6 months and I don't know how many days.
Fantastic.
Now, and just trying to, you know, it's the same thing that my man told me on day one. He goes, look, buddy, all you got to do is get to bed tonight without drinking or using. Don't hurt yourself or anybody else. If you make a mistake, try to make it better. Get help if you need it and try to help somebody else. If you do that, go to bed tonight. You've done it perfectly as anybody. Get up tomorrow and do the same thing. Is that it? Yeah, that's it. Okay. Like there was more to it, obviously. But
yeah. Well, things unfold. Life comes on. Yeah.
It's like, and that's kind of it. And that pathway, I didn't believe it would work. But
who does in that space? And then they ask you to believe in a higher power. It's like, what are you talking about? Oh, you might, and if you bring the God word out, and that's really tricky.
Well, I really struggled with that. You know, because of the school I went to and various experiences when I was younger, I was like, nah, not interested.
And you can see it going on all around the world right now. You know, like right at this very moment. Oh, it's God. Oh, da 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 da. It goes on and on.
Yeah.
And it's the human experiences. Is you go, oh my God, they're using that word again.
But it has shaped so much of our society, but it eventually, again, I listened to a lot of stuff around then and I heard a story about a guy that would use his tractor. He was a farmer and he used his tractor because his man, his sponsor just basically said, I don't care, just got to pick something bigger than you. So he picked his tractor because without his tractor, he couldn't feed his family, couldn't look after his land, couldn't keep that roof over their head. And so respected this thing, did right by it. And it's like, whatever it is, mate.
And you can care for a tractor.
Just pick something bigger than you.
Yeah.
Pick something bigger than you and that's it.
And
it's a great story, isn't it?
That's amazing. And just like your vehicle or something that you, or anything you care for, you can animate it in the mind.
Yeah.
So it just animates and it does its thing. And I mean, if you look at something for long enough, it starts to animate. It's naturally it. You know, I'm a father of three daughters. Watching them do their thing and just be there to support them now, particularly now, being able to support and be there and just, you know, they just get out there and do their stuff. They want to do good things. It's just that's the innate thing in us humans. We do want to do good things.
Yeah.
Sometimes we take it a little far, but, you know.
No, we generally do. It's built into us. Yeah. We come out like that. Mm. When they were little, did you, like, at what point did they realize that dad had a different job? Like when just endless amounts of men would come up to you and want to shake your hand, people that you didn't know?
I think it was pretty soon because I was doing the tour.
Yeah.
When the first two came, I was on tour with Jenna, who's now 31, and Amelia, who came in 2 years like to the day later.
Wow.
They both were on the tour with me for a couple of years, wow, trying to change nappies and just travel, and it just got too much. We surrendered, Lisa and I, my ex-wife and their mother surrendered to, okay, if I want to keep the tour, you know, we're going to have to split up here for a while. And I thought, I just can't be without. And I found it hard to be full aggressive, competitive mode, competition mode, and on the tour and not be close by. And so I found it really hard. And then actually coming home was even harder because the structure wasn't there anymore. And so
yeah, it
was very
right.
tricky. Yeah, it was a very tricky time.
There's as much as I'm not a fan of the things that those guys have done, there's a book by a band called Motley Crue.
Yeah.
And there's a line from Tommy Lee that says, I wish someone wrote a book, What to Do Now You've Come Home from Tour.
Bingo.
Because I read that and I went, yes.
Mm.
Because you go from this humongous amount of stimulation and, you know, for me, it was just stimulation. For you, it was that and I might die.
Yeah. And there's a strong purpose. Yeah, the strong sense of purpose.
Yes.
You know,
there's a big comedy check that's going to pay for the kids' Christmas presents.
And it overrides the family to some degree, you know, like because your ego's been stroked so far with it. So all of a sudden you think you're like, well, they've got to kind of do what I got to do, you know.
Yeah.
And then you just go, hang on, they can't. And then there's a kind of tearing in,
yeah,
in the guts, like it's right in there.
It's extraordinary. Mm. We're here talking because, and I'm grateful we're able to do this because the first time we spoke, I don't think I wasn't really in the space or able really to have the conversation to the, you know, how I would like to have it with you today. But at any point, if there's stuff you don't want to talk about, I'm not here to do anything sensational. But there's the thing that in Australia, you know, people may not realize how much help there is for addiction. And you told me last time we spoke, you told me about the work that was being done at South Pacific Private. And it sounded very much like the kind of stuff that I heard from the upper end of the ethical spectrum of rehab in the States. There's a very, very terribly low end.
Yes.
As I'm sure there is everywhere. But it made me incredibly happy to know that was there because of all the things to try to come back from, methamphetamines is like, that is, it Ooh. Just fucks your brain. It totally rewrites shit.
Mm.
And to know that that help is available for people, that it's even here, is amazing.
Yeah. Well, that moment for me when I was assessed, I knew that I was informed by my sponsor in NA, which I couldn't get you know, clean what he called on the streets, because you just had too many masks between me and you. I just had too much stuff to try and cope with my reality that was so well orchestrated, articulately put into place that I couldn't sort of see through myself. So he was saying, look, Tommy, you'll need to get some distance from the substances because, you know, a few months going in and out of the rooms saying I'm clean, I'm going to know all the spinning the stories, trying to say I'm high as a kite, right? And that tearing apart of that self at that point, some glimmer of like conscience was saying, okay, Tom, what my sponsor was saying was right. Okay, there's some part of me, just a little little spark. And so that's when I went and got assessed to go into South Pacific. And that was in like November 2006. And they gave me a date of December 18.
Whoa.
I told my daughters, who were then 13 and 15, and, you know, with my ex-wife, and, you know, and the fear in her eyes was enough for me to kind of go, whoa, what am I doing? You know, like, and the distance that I was creating between me and my daughters, you know, just by just trying to cope, hiding this sort of drug use and this addiction, you know, which was overrunning. And as you know, it just gets bigger in the dark. It just sort of grows and grows in the dark, as it does, like a whole bunch of fungi. And it cracked. Finally started crying and all this stuff started coming out with this lady. She assessed me and she said, oh, you're definitely, we're going to give you the date. I can give you December 18. It was a five-week program back then.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over Christmas. And so
how many days between that date and check-in?
I had a trip to the US to do with my sponsor, Quicksilver. Things got pretty hectic in the US. I got out of there via Tahiti to go surfing on the way back home. Got pretty crazy. I got back home, landed on the ground, and then, you know, we had this young, beautiful little daughter, you know, Grace, who'd come into the world, who I'd been using to try and cope with everything around me.
Yeah.
And all the speed of action, and I just couldn't sort of cope, so I was trying to use something that kind of helped me feel like I was coping, which was working for a while, right? And this beautiful little girl, and it was just very, very hectic in my house at that time. A lot of action, a lot of trying to deal with what was going on. And Grace was, back then, she didn't appear graceful to me because of my inner experience. She was like a baseball bat over the head. And she'd go, Dad, 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 like trying to get my attention. I'm like, shoot, like this.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember Lisa knew, my ex-wife, knew that this was what had to happen, and it was going in the right direction, even though it just seemed like hell. And she goes, but right at the last moment, she goes, you know, I think it's December 16 or something, she goes, can you just do it after Christmas, like because of Christmas? And I've just gone, no, because in the back of my head, if I don't do it now, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I could go anywhere from here. And from what I've just been doing, and I've been taking it, because you just want to use more. You just want to pile as much as you can into you, because not only do you think it's the end, so addiction comes on stronger into the system. So active addiction was very powerful at that point, and I fell into South Pacific in December 18, 2006.
That little gap of light, I can absolutely relate to that.
Yeah.
Like when I was at my sickest, it was just like, well, everything else is darkness, and that's the same as always, and it's just getting darker. But that, if I just go and try and go in that direction just for a second and see what's there. And ultimately, that's the thing that
but
I was lucky.
Yeah, you know. And it wasn't me kind of wanting to do it. Like, I didn't even know I wanted to be clean. I didn't even know. That's what I did. I've been doing it for years, and I've been acting out in this disease for a long time.
Yeah.
And in and out of it trying to wrestle it to the ground, wrestle myself to the ground, internally.
Whatever substance it is, addiction's addiction.
Yeah.
All right? And it could be process addiction, could be pokies, could be shopping, could be sex, it could be alcohol, which it was for me. It was beer, you know.
Yeah.
It's not hard spirits. It's not, but that wasn't my weapon of choice. Doesn't really matter what it is. There is eventually no amount of it that will be enough. You know, and for me, it was like many things at once as well.
Yeah.
It was everything at the same time. And you're right, it works until it doesn't, you know, but the dosage or the amount you need to get it to work is just a little further away every single time. Do you remember, I remember the first time I had a beer, it was like, this is it. It's the magic potion. I can walk into a party full of people. I feel brilliant. Hooray. I found it. And do you remember the first time when it was like, oh, hang on, no, this might be causing me issues. It seems to be happening every time things get bad.
It was a while, long time before that. Back in the late 80s, I was exposed to a lot of cocaine and at once, just at this in Hawaii, actually. And there was a place where I never associated with so much like the hard drugs. And there's a friend of mine who's a dealer, and it was just very plentiful.
Mate, you were who you were in that scene. I can tell you, I just talk about this a bit. Like, I think I maybe bought that kind of drug maybe twice. It was always around.
Yeah.
Hey, mate. Hey, I'll let something in there for you. Be my honour. Let me.
Yeah.
Like, sure.
Yeah. Okay. just take that. You know. I'll give you that. You just take. That's for you. I go, what that thing? I go, what am I going to do with that? And and it's the ego drug, right? It's the ego drug. So if you've got, you're just pumped up. You're just thinking you're killing it. Like, straight away, almost instantly. It's very instant, but it's got the up and down very quick. And I got pretty caught up in that. Particularly, I think it's around mid 80s, like 85, 86 winter, when the tour had finished there, and I spent just a little bit more time there, and things kicked into gear, and it was quite a load on. That was second year I was exposed to that same person, and this person, he just got more and more and more. It was like incredible amounts, and it got to a point where I just couldn't. I had to get off the island and get on a flight and get out of there. And I get home, I go, oh my god, it'd be just before New Year's. I'd missed Christmas at home. I'd be like crawling off the plane, going, oh my god, I got home, and I just pull myself together, and I'd go, okay, for the next few months, I'm just going to get myself together and get back on this, you know, what I love doing, which is on the tour and surfing and pull myself together. So, and then I'd work towards becoming successful again at what I was doing, and you get a little bit of success, you get a couple of really peak moments, and then party time. So the roller coaster began, in essence, there. And it's not like, you know, I really got, once I was sort of in South Pacific and I started getting exposed to, and I was ready for it, by the way. I didn't know it, but I was finally kind of opened up to, okay, I'm away from everything. I can just fall apart here. I felt like I was starting to fall apart. And I was cracked open, you know, and I love that Leonard Cohen song, you know, the one where, you know, there's a crack in everything. And
I don't know enough Leonard Cohen. I only know the one about Berlin.
So he talks about the crack. There's a crack in everything.
Right.
That's where the light gets in, you know. And so, you know, it's beautiful and it made a lot of sense, you know. Yeah. And here I am, I'm cracked, and I was open to, you know, sort of looking back inside, which I wasn't, I couldn't look back. I couldn't look back. I was trying as fast as I could away from myself the other way. Now I just naturally wanted to come back in and start to look at what was behind all this for me. And because I didn't like looking at my daughters and thinking that they're in the way of me using. You know, I didn't like that feeling. It was like it was tearing me up and it was dislocating. And
I'm sure it showed up as a great idea when it did.
Well, then see, all of a sudden they're not human.
Yeah.
Right? I lose the humanness of my daughters, which is just it's so sad, that moment. You know, it's a very sad, and I know it when it, you know it when it's happening, because there's still that flicker of consciousness because you're awake, you're seeing it, but you override it with the addiction. So the addiction has to come on stronger to survive. And the addict's always trying to survive, right? So it starts using everyone and everything, right?
Yeah.
So finally cracked, you know. And in that addict space, you're really wrapping yourself with a whole bunch of armor to try and survive.
Yeah.
And so you can't get in there. The person to get in there to let the light in. To crack, right?
There's so much about though that you know the biggest symptom of addiction is convincing it that's not there, and that it will defend itself as you just described so wonderfully. It'll defend itself at all costs, and you'll find yourself justifying things more and more and more. And I talk about this when I speak on stage about this kind of stuff. Mm. I'm like, I remember like a Tuesday, I don't know, it's like 2 p.m. I'm day drinking, I'm playing two tables of internet poker, gambling hundreds of dollars an hour away with two. I was fancy, I had two screens, you know, there, while furiously masturbating to increasingly more intense porn over here while I was waiting for the hands to deal. And if someone called me, what are you doing? I was like, oh, I was just hanging out at home, mate. It's just Tuesday.
See, it's like it like at best, it's insane, right? It's ridiculous. That's what I heard when I heard this speaker, this Mark L. from California, is talking on the speaker tape. When I first started hearing speaker tape, he talked about this addiction at best is ridiculous, right? At best. At worst is death. So what we're working with as a human under the influence of our addict is ridiculous to death. It's not much, going on, and highly destructive. So and so from looking from the outside, you're just going, what the hell is this?
I couldn't understand why no one wanted to come over, Tom.
Yeah.
Oh, this was great.
Yeah.
Like, when you think, like now, I mean, that made perfect sense for me to do at that point. And I think this is the thing you spoke about your daughters, so this is the thing I think for family of alcoholics and addicts to really understand is like that is the best option they have available to them right now. They probably know full well how dangerously destructive it is to themselves and to their relationships and to everyone around them. They literally don't have anything else to do except for that. That is the best choice they can make right now. And that's a hard thing to come to, that this is the best idea that I had. You know, because that was the only thing that I could do to feel okay on that day.
yeah. Just to sort of get to some sort of feeling of, I don't know, normal.
Oh,
so, to get to that thing. So, you know, coming back, you know, back around to, you know, looking at my daughters and that little light of conscience sort of coming up and seeing them, and then at that moment where I was able to be open to going to South Pacific private, and that I didn't know it was available. I didn't know the 12-step program was available, that people actually sharing about this sort of stuff honestly between each other. I had no idea about that stuff.
That you weren't a special snowflake, and in fact that this actually happens pretty much word for word to a lot of people.
Yeah, I thought it was very, very special. And actually I had really special help. I started people around me saying, you need help, in 1991.
Oh,
so that started, what is it, 15 years?
I was about the same, actually. The first person who I loved me desperately, like we loved each other, said to me, you really want to have a think about what you're doing? This is like, What is this? Do this to yourself all the time. Yeah. Ah, I'm not my dad. Yeah. Mm. 15 years.
15 big ones. And I think that's kind of runs along the line. I hear about, you know, relationship, when we're in relationship with anything, really, whether it's with ourselves, with our partners. Quite often it's talked about as the 7-year itch, right? Yeah, and then there's got to be some sort of evolving elements in the relationship that need to take part for that relationship to go deeper on the 7 years, after the 7 year or around that 7 year, 8 year, whatever. And then there's another one that comes around, so to either establish a deeper one or separate. You know, you have that 7 year itch. So it makes sense as 15 years at some point, because it's all about relationship with ourself, this one, well, with the substances, with whatever it is you're using, but ultimately it's this relationship that needs attention. So we're sort of running away from each other. So that makes two times seven for both of us. It took us to kind of come to some sort of.
I don't know about you, mate, but I doubled down at halftime.
Yeah,
I really did.
Yeah.
By the end of it, it was very clear that I had to, you know. But I, you know, I guess what kept me out, and I wonder if this is the same thing with you, what kept me out of getting help was the shame of, if I go get help, that means I need help, and I don't want to be the person that needs help, so I won't get help. Mm. And I wonder if, you know, that had kept you out or kept you from seeking help.
I didn't know how to ask for help. I just didn't have that language in me yet.
Right.
It's a sort of a new language altogether. It was had to be learned.
Which is interesting for me, because you were one of the first pro surfers to actively start working with trainers to, you know, do cross training, to develop musculature outside of surfing. Mm. Now it was like, what's he doing? It's like, you know, you were the only guy doing it. And now everybody's got a coach.
Well, you know? I think addicts, alcoholics, whatever you want to call a disease, this disease comes and expressed in 700 billion, you know, what is it? How many humans on the planet? So expressed, right?
Yeah.
And I think some of the most creative, most extraordinary human beings on this planet that have lived on this planet have the disease. This, we call it disease. I don't know what to say. It's just an entity that comes through us and expresses itself, so we can focus in it and do what we need to do and actually get really good at what we're doing. A lot of it. And I was listening to a podcast just recently, Michael Gervais.
Oh, he's great.
Finding Mastery. I've forgotten the, but it's about perfectionism.
Yeah.
And it's a brilliant listen. And it picks up on something that I really suffered from. And it can be attached to something that will come from a part of a bit of an imbalance sort of, you know, care when you're a kid, you know, sort of trauma from when you're a kid. So perfectionism comes up.
Right.
And it came up for me and expressed through me, and I wanted to get really good at what I was doing. I just wanted to get really good, and I'd do anything. And surfing, it's a super healthy thing. Like it divinely sort of lifts your body and your spirit, and it just makes you feel so good. And it actually builds your body. You know, if you've got a body that's ready to build and it responds to it, and you got all the makeup to do it, it'll really allow the body and the mind to express itself in a beautiful way. There's no doubt about it. I see it all the time. But for me, it was really like there was all these stepping stones all of a sudden placed ahead of me, and this structure of competition, which I wasn't really a competitive surfer when I first started surfing. I just did it because it was fun. But then all of a sudden there's all these things that sort of happen that I got tagged into it. Not only do I have a really competitive brother, older brother, that was just 24/7 competitive, but I bit in and it started to kind of express itself through competition, and I got real good at it. But, you know, along the way, you know, I just couldn't get enough. and I couldn't control. I remember trying to control my performances. And it just was, it was brutal. I learnt that I couldn't really control it. but I kept trying to control it. And I think if drugs didn't ignite the addict in that way, the addict would have probably found its way, because underlying all that stuff, there was trauma. There was trying to express itself and so on in certain different ways. But as soon as it sort of felt that sensation of, you know, I think generally speaking, when I heard about this from a therapist talking about, you know, being below the line, subtly below the line, there's your nice, you know, your happy medium, your character sort of moving along in this line. You're not feeling good or bad. You're just in the nice space, mm-hmm. and you're, I might have been just a little below the line for the most time, just right. sort of by something within my system.
Yeah.
When I touched a drug like cocaine, methamphetamine and so on, it sort of put me above the line. So I went, so the jigsaw puzzle fit, and it fit so nice that I could actually engage more, which I just wanted to do. Yeah. I love engagement. I love people, and I just love that. Let's get in there and engage more. That's fantastic. And that's what surfing did for me too. It helped me, you know, come out of myself and engage with people and get involved and in a bigger world. Thank God for surfing. But when it sort of turned, when this part of me that wasn't seen as I evolved and tried to grow up, I don't think I really grew up, by the way, still trying, still
if there's attempting. If there's any professional sport in the world that encourages its greatest athletes to, I mean, it's the only sport, really,
yeah.
where you literally just go out there and play.
Yeah.
You literally play.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
You're not trying to fight anyone. You're not trying to get a ball from here to there. You're just going out there to be just, playful.
Yeah, and artistically play on the wave. And yeah, and just play.
It's
and
amazing.
Just enjoy yourself and just go.
As a great man. There's no other sport that lets you do that. And then rewards you for it.
Yeah, and it used to confuse me sometimes. I get to go out here and do this for my job. And sometimes it would be I'm out here trying to do my job. These people are in the way, you know, you know, to get a bit hectic, you know, in the 80s particularly. But when the addict sort of, you know, doesn't want to be seen, you know, it starts to express itself through the use of something that is damaging me, the shame. You're talking about shame and guilt. That starts coming in spades. And the fact that I can't, you know, God, I just... Why do I want to kind of stay up when everyone else is, like, done? Why do I want to go and get more? Why do I want to call the dealer? Why do I want to, you know, like, just go that much further? And, like, how come it's okay for me to do it day in, day out for a while until I'm completely toasted, where everyone seems to I'll have a couple of those and then I'm done? So that was presenting itself more regularly as the responsibilities of a life outside the sport started to sort of play on me.
Just listening to you then, you touched on something which I know that, you know, Johan Hari's written about in his book, Lost Connections. Mm. Very much it is not only a connection with yourself and being comfortable with who you are, but it's connecting with other people. And if we have not kind of figured out how to safely connect with other people, which was, as I described before, it's what beer gave me, you know, oh, it's this thing. Now I can talk to you.
Yeah.
Or if we're not able to connect with ourselves because of something that happened to us when we were younger, because there's something icky there that we don't like going near, then we're in trouble. So what would you say about, for people who are listening, around I guess, traumatic moments or, you know, big T, little T trauma, whatever it is, like untreated? Like, it's going to happen. You can't stop it. It could have nothing to do with you. It usually has nothing to do with you. But untreated... What can happen if it's, you know, if you're walking through life with trauma from when you're a kid?
it's a big one. It's so individual because it's how we responded to those moments that happened. That it's not the actual thing that happened. It's how we responded inside, right? So that made us sort of turn, get that imprint into the nervous system. So it's going to come up, and it's like whack-a-mole, right? You know that thing? Just keeps coming up in some way, shape, or form.
I used to play in Grundy's.
Did
You played it at Grundy's. That's cool.
That's where I played it. It's the only place I ever played it.
Yeah.
I think there was one at Dreamworld eventually, but that's where I played it. I played at Grundy's.
Bang, bang.
Yeah.
And it comes up as the memory sort of imprints and it sort of comes up if it's a powerful one.
Yeah.
And they talk about PTSD, you know, today. I mean, in back, you know, when I was six, I lost my mum really slowly, you know, like it happened over a year and my brain wasn't formed emotionally. With that hardware, it wasn't there. So no wonder I had difficulty having a relationship with women. I just struggled allowing them close to me. Very, very tricky. And I just, it was terrifying. And it wasn't, till I came into recovery where I could, you know, drop all the substances and then start to look at it. And we need help looking at that stuff. We can't, you know, go with this alone, right? We need to sort of go on an adventure tour within.
An adventure tour.
An adventure tour within and see it. But the cosmic laugh here is that I've had three daughters.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Like that's...
You better learn this now, Tom. It's like get in there, learn it. Get in there and figure this out because you got... Three beautiful women, like they're young women expressing themselves, and they're going to keep coming up with stuff, and you're going to have to be there for them. And so, and you don't never know what form that's going to take.
Yeah.
But I definitely, you know, I hope I can be mature enough.
Because, well, that's the thing.
Comes, you know.
You know, but that's the thing, and it's a trick. But early on, when and you know. People may not understand this part about addiction is that ultimately, well, at least drinking, at least, and I'm sure it's the same with, you know, amphetamines. Mm. It shuts, it disconnects the memory from the action emotionally. So you can remember that some shit went wrong, but you don't connect your action to the shit that went wrong.
Yeah.
So you don't feel that, oh, fuck, I really fucked that up. I should probably do better about that. You don't have that. See, that's why you do the same fucking thing the next time you are me and you drink tequila or anything. And so what happens then is when I stop drinking and using, now I have to start again. So I started drinking like that when I was about 14, right?
Mm.
And I had to start again at 36. I had to start, essentially, here I am, I'm 36 and I've got a 14-year-old brain ability to look at the world.
Mm.
It was hard to figure that out.
Mm.
As someone who's, you know, you mentioned perfectionism, someone who's like arguably like found the pinnacle of the pinnacles of the sport they've chosen, what was it like to be faced with the humility of like, oh, man, I don't know how to do this. I'm going to have to learn. I don't like not being good at this.
Yeah. Well, just the position that I found myself in that I couldn't stop and that I was actually – using and saying the word God help me when I didn't like the word. I didn't know what I was praying to. It was a prayer. I never said a prayer in my life. You know, I was like, God help me, because I knew that I couldn't get enough of it and it was going nowhere. I was frying myself. I could feel it. I was feeling like crap, like weak. I couldn't keep a conversation with people because I couldn't. And my memory was so fried that I was trying to kind of keep the conversation. It was such a simple thing. I could never remember. It was just, I go, oh, my God, I'm in a lot of danger. I felt in danger. And I remember that I was just getting enough of recovery in me through the 12-step fellowship that I was sort of offered the hand of the 12-step fellowship. And the kind of love around me that I didn't connect to at all was actually rallying to kind of guide me towards this person who became my first sponsor in Narcotics Anonymous. Rest in peace, Muzz, the fantastic first sponsor. He kind of took me to my first meeting, and I think it was like August in 2006, early September, where I first started going to meetings in my hometown. I'm like freaking out, going, someone's going to get know me, you know, like, you know, like I was just I was freaking out.
That's the shame, isn't it?
That's a shame.
Dude, I was
going to
another country. I was going to another fucking country, and I was terrified that someone recognised me.
But I knew it didn't make any sense that I was had this beautiful life and this was happening to me.
Yeah.
And I was like sitting in these meetings going, I was so mad. I couldn't hear because my thoughts were so crazy. But I could just identify with a couple of words, just little bits of sentences that were people were saying and that people were being honest about what was going on. And I was just going, oh my God, I hadn't been honest about anything for a long time. So to be honest, something was happening in those rooms without me actually bringing it in that I didn't know about. And that was, again, it was something a lot bigger than me. I kind of sensed it. Yeah. But I didn't. Part of me, that little conscience, that little flicker that was still there and that we're trying to snuff out was going, that's maybe the spot, Tom. Maybe. And I've been trying to do it by one-on-one with counsellors and therapists over time, and I knew I could just work it. You know, I could stick the masks on and
say what you needed to say.
Say what I needed to think. Get out of there. Keep people off my back.
Yeah.
And the addict was going, whoa. You know, like, I got you now.
It's kind of interesting. I still have to keep an eye out for it. I'm sure you do too.
Absolutely.
I have all this hip surgery I did without painkillers because painkillers were part of the last couple of months, right? Panadol and Nurofen, that was it. But after the first surgery, well, I had to, man. Because and I know why. I even told the people after the first surgery that I had, they gave me tapentadol, which is a synthetic opioid, because I told them everything. I had to tell them everything.
Yeah.
Because I was like, don't give me anything that's a problem. And when I took the first one after I got back from the hospital after the first surgery, I felt it come up. And I use those words because it wasn't, I didn't feel the drugs kick in. I didn't feel the pain go away. I felt the drug come up. All right. It's very different.
That.
Very
that,
different way
exactly
of talking about it.
That's exactly how it
happens. Changes my relationship to this feeling, right? And in the space of less than a breath, my brain went, okay, so there's 13 more and this. I've got fucking this many days. I'm going to take the white consult. There's a GP. I'll go to the other one around the corner. It's going to, they don't know me. And my brain already knew exactly what I was going to say to the GP. And I just passed a packet to Audrey. And I said, unless I really need it, hide it from me.
The most creative, when we want to be the most creative, take the most initiative, faster than anyone else on the planet. And plan it perfectly to the T and you'll make it happen. It's like, it's incredible. Whereas if it's got something to do with someone else, oh, I don't want to do that. You know, I'm going to do something for someone else.
I was a master at it. But so people might be, you know, people listening and they may have their ideas about addiction, what addiction might be. What do you think, particularly with amphetamines, what do you think is the biggest misconception about that?
That it's seedy. It's only for the seedy crew. Like it's only for the real down and out seedy part of town.
It's even in the language. Like it's a glass Barbie. Is what we call. You know,
right,
we call it the glass Barbie.
It's the glass Barbie. Well, there it is. The glass Barbie. Mm. I mean, it's amphetamines. Literally, we've got it in our makeup. We've got the drug in us anyway. We don't need it. Mm. So, but we can double it up in the system and actually become more, for a moment in time, become more effective and more clear about what we're doing decision-wise. We can get more productive. We become more, just more of everything comes in and you become very clear about what you need to do about whatever's in front of you. So it's a very, very alluring to those who want to be productive in life. And so the thing is this drug is everywhere. It's not just in this thin slither of, oh, they're down and out. It's on ice, you know, the ice. It's the ice, you know. Oh, isn't it just a horrible drug? Da-da-da-da. It's not the drug. It's never been the drug. It's the person that it touches And if they're in a situation where they're not looking at and they're not aware of themselves and what's going on, and they touch something like this, it will take them. It will take them for quite a ride, and until you address it, it will keep taking everything away from you. So it's very, very clear. The evidence is very real, and I'm watching it at the moment with someone who's quite successful. They've reached out for help. They're a business person, very successful in what they do, and they're struggling. They can't stop. It will take the businesses away. It'll take his relationships away. And I'm watching this situation, and I learnt this prayer in the rooms of AA, but for the grace of God, there go I. And I'm really thankful for that prayer, because I try to control him otherwise, and I need that prayer. The prayer is a very, very powerful prayer.
Yeah.
When we see someone suffering and we can't, all I can do is give him my support and the fact that I've been there, and that's why he's reaching out.
It's interesting you mentioned that. It's not that the story we tell ourselves that it's only the scuzzy part of town, or it's only like people who are you know living in this particular form of housing or whatever. It really doesn't care what postcode you live in. It does not care how much money you make. In fact, if you make a lot of money, you're probably in far more danger, because the bottom financially isn't there.
Well, I don't know like how much the last big haul was, but the volume of methamphetamine coming into the country right now would be, God knows, 10 times that which was the last haul. I don't know, it was a massive
haul. It's in the hundreds of tons.
Yeah. So where's that going?
So they're testing the sewage water, not the people. They're testing the sewage water to find out where
it's.
And it's like that's how it just everywhere this drug is. And it is so extraordinarily addictive. There was a guy, if you could speak a little bit about that, because from what I know of it is that there's a guy that I met early on in my journey, and he had gotten clean and was huge in the gay scene before it kind of crossed over into kind of the straight world, because it was quite associated with sex.
Yeah.
If you need some wood cut, you can come and talk to. If you need something very, if you need some diamond split in two, come give me a call. Yeah. I was there, man.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's why they would use it. And this guy, he went out on a grinder date, knocked on the front door, the door opened, the boy went, and he blew. He just inhaled and he blew it in his face, and that was it. He was out for another 2 years or something.
There you go.
Fucking easy. Terrible.
I can imagine that. And if they're, like I said, if there's something awaiting in the background that you're not aware of, and you touch something that sort of insatiates, if it's something that's causing kind of discomfort underneath you, you're not quite sure, something informing each day, something that kind of dragging you down, or something that's sort of emotionally not being seen or not being expressed, it's being held down, trying to sort of control it in any sort of way, and then something comes along like this. It could be the other way too. It could be opioids on that sort of spectrum, but particularly this sort of thing can come along and sort of give you some sort of space from it. So you sort of, I don't feeling that anymore. Oh, gosh, I'm going to go for that. And it sets up just a pattern. And we're just a bunch of patterns walking around, right? We are just a bunch of patterns. I haven't even seen this movie, but The Matrix, every time I hear about, you know, all of what The Matrix
you
is
dig
about,
it.
I can't wait to see
it's
it.
It's one of my favorites. I watch it once a year just to watch it.
Yeah, yeah. It's so a good one. It's going on inside us. So it's playing out, and we're connected to people and our closer people, and we're just patterns.
But it's getting space from the discomfort. It's getting space from the discomfort. Yeah. So what would you say about what it is to turn and be with that discomfort? Because this is a thing that you know, I certainly did, and it sounds like you did as well, tried to put as much as I could to avoid getting anywhere near it for so long. And every time I avoided it, it got bigger and scarier and worse. What would you say about what it feels like, what you think might happen when you turn and face it, and what actually happens?
What it turns out in the end is that what we've been looking for all along is love. It's the one healing element in the universe that actually allows us to move toward it for the first time in our life. And that it's that endless whole sense of being supported into the trauma. Gabor Mate wrote a beautiful book just recently called The Myth of Normal. And I think that he's got some great observations of human nature, and he's worked directly with it. So he's got a great command of what's going on. But trauma itself, when I read that book, it was really uncomfortable reading that book for me. But moving toward it, having the support, the sense that there's love involved with that support, that, you know, it comes along and that sort of tends to hold you in that space where you can actually sort of be with it, it tends to dissolve on its own accord. It was so long ago, this thing that happened. It's no longer, and the system itself wants to get rid of it. Our nature wants to discard what's irrelevant. Our nature, it's just, we are nature. And nature's just going to discard whatever's irrelevant, right? A tree loses its flowers and they fall on the ground. They're irrelevant to the tree. They become more relevant to the earth then. And then they do the cycle back through, enrich the earth. And so this is what happens. Then the trauma becomes informing at a very, very enriched, earthy space. Once it sort of, does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so it sort of comes back, and now what looks like you've been dragged into the worst position in your whole life turns around and becomes the most informative and most bright informative part of your life. Like it actually starts to become vibrant in its form once again. So you come out of this, you think the whole world's coming around, you're going to lose your best friend and like the thing that's been supporting you, even though it's been fully kicking
it's
your ass.
It's your identity. It's part of your identity. It's part of certainly, you know, what can sometimes drive you even, you know?
So Eckhart Tolle, you know, the great spiritual teacher, talks about that. Our greatest moments can inform our greatest, you know, the bottom of the, which it did for me, it informed that because my ego just went, oh, I can't do that. Oh, I'm going to go down. I'm going to head south as fast as I could. And then that gets cracked and then you come back out and start to move in the direction, hopefully. Now, hopefully. Yeah. It's not a smooth ride.
Yeah.
So it's not a smooth ride and not for the faint-hearted. So, but I think the great thing about, and such a valuable resource is both the, you know, places like South Pacific and the 12-Step Fellowship, if you can avail yourself to sitting with people, that's the whole thing for an hour and just listening.
Yeah.
Extraordinary things happen.
My man who guides me, an extraordinary bloke called David, he's fantastic. One of the steps is a fifth one, and you sit down in a very quiet place. There's two of you, and you talk about some stuff that you otherwise would never say anyone ever in the world. And he says, it's okay, man. Like, this means you don't forget it. Like, all this stuff is still this, but now I know about it. So it's now off your hands. But now you get to remember this and just keep living your life in the other direction. Like, it's never going to leave you.
Yeah.
But you get to live your life. Here's the best lines. Like, look, I've got good news. You get to live the rest of your life not being that guy anymore. And like, you're right, it doesn't leave you, but it informs you to then become a version of yourself that you didn't even believe existed.
And you couldn't have even imagined it.
No, fuck.
That's the
thing. I thought it was a fairy story. It's like, obviously, you're making up a joke.
Yeah.
Like, there's no. I know what happens when I drink beer is what happened on the telly. Mm. Alan Board is there, Tomo's there, and a girl in a bikini shows up. Yeah. That's what happens. Yeah. Never did, but I believed it.
Yeah.
How do you feel?
You know? Yeah.
It's like suddenly I'm having a beer in the changing chest. Yeah. Because it's like, alcohol marketing's got a lot to answer for.
Bro. Oh, no, they know what to do. Marketing in general has been extraordinary.
Tell me about it. So to go, we're talking about like South Pacific Private. It has an outpatient facility.
Mm.
But when people was like, I'm going to go into rehab, residential rehab, to get away, put some distance between yourself and it. Why is that important?
Well, our lives, you know, in our family, it could be because it's a whole dynamic that you're living within. It can be overwhelming and consuming, and we've actually moved away from making a decision for ourselves around anything. In fact, the addict will put the decision on everyone else. So you've put decisions off, like to do something about something that's inside you. You're going, it's someone else's fault, you know. They can sort of, you know, I'll wait till this happens. Oh, well maybe I'll wait till tomorrow and I'll do it then, you know. And then, you know, well, it's like, you know, anytime you try and do a New Year's resolution and it's like, you know, Boxing Day, and maybe the day after Boxing Day and you're just really hurting and you're just going, oh, okay, New Year's resolution, I'm planning this out. And you give a little gap between that and the day and all your demons come out to play.
Yeah, right.
And that happens at all these little different levels, so to the point where you're in this family dynamic or you're in the way of living that you're in, that the demons are constantly coming up. Well, if you like to call demons, but it's just the dis-ease of this condition.
And the people who've been living with it aren't you.
And they're, and it's kind of their fault. And then on top of that, they could be enabling you. I mean, it could be all sorts of all this dynamic going on. So we need to get respite. We need to actually either you make a full-on decision and it makes really clear sense and you end up in a 12-step fellowship, which is fantastic. And some people do. They get clean doing that and clean and sober. But, you know, the way things are, if we can get to a facility where you can fall apart in support, in really sound evidence-based support, surrounded by professionals, people that can actually, you can start to sort of work in group, which we really need to, because a lot of us have been isolating. You know, I mean, in fact, it is just an isolation.
I did all my best drinking and using alone, mate.
Yeah.
I wasn't the party. It was me by myself.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we weren't relating to anyone.
Nope.
So usually, you know, the South Pacific one's for 3 weeks now, but they've got a sort of a step-down program, which I remember doing. I ended up being in there twice that for 6 weeks. Because my therapist said, I think if you can stay in for an extra week, Tom, I'd advise it. And I've gone, okay. I was actually enjoying it being in there at the end because I'd been through a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff had lifted off me. I felt lighter even though I was crazy. It doesn't just go away, right? That early days and I was getting some time and distance away from using. I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, I heard a lot of stories about people using the day they got out of.
Oh man!
That could have been on for me. And I thought, I'm starting to feel good now. And the fact that I had that distance, I kind of sensed that now I really wanted to. There was a moment in there where the penny dropped, I guess, if you like. And I started doing some practices of meditation in the morning, every morning. On my own, and just becoming more engaged and hearing the feedback from other clients and so on in there, and making friends in there and sort of connecting naturally, And some vibrance was coming back in me, and I wanted to go back home. Like, I wanted to go back home like me again, and that's how I felt. And after a very, very dislocated time for probably the previous 12 months, getting increasingly more dislocated and disconnected. And so the step-down program, I went, right, I'm on for that. That was three sessions. It was like 12 weeks of it. So it was three sessions for 3 weeks, two sessions for two, for 3 weeks. And I think a couple of sessions a week for another three, and then one for the, and step down. And then I stayed with that and just kept on doing, you know, my friends in Narcotics Anonymous, I just allowed myself to get towed in by them, you know.
Just a moment away from Tom Carroll to say, look, if you need me, you can find me. sandosheremail@gmail.com. And if this episode is something that is bringing you some value, the best thing you can do for me that costs you absolutely nothing is to just tell somebody, email it, share it, like it, subscribe to it, leave a comment, talk about it in the comments box. All that stuff really helps more people find the show, because more people that find the show, the more we get paid for ads. So you're making us money, the more you tell. So I'm, rather than asking you to send me money directly, you send me people. Text it, share it, however. There's probably an ellipse or an arrow or a paper plane or something in the corner of your podcast app. Just share the link and share it to someone, let them know. Send it to your dad. He'll know who Tom Carroll is. and if you do have, if you have a bit of time, that listener survey that I talked about before, you can find it in the show notes. We're back with more from Tom Carroll in a moment.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
What about the, you know, you get out and then, hey, I heard you're out, mate. We're down to the, you know, we're at the Newport Arms. Come on.
Really, you know, my whole home environment was very uncomfortable. Everything was super uncomfortable. But the meetings and my support were saying, okay, because I had to learn how to sit with discomfort. That was the big one too.
That's really it, isn't it?
It's learning how to sit. That's the big thing about meetings, is you're sitting in the room. You're being you're literally being supported just by sitting there.
Yeah.
To sit there and listen. Like, I couldn't hear a thing, but at first, but hearing you was to come much later. But the fact that I was sitting through meetings and not wanting to run was a revelation to me.
There's guys I called mates.
Yeah.
I never texted or called after that day. And you know what, Tom? They never texted or called me.
It
was like, all right, our entire relationship was not based on friendship. Okay.
it's incredibly, how's that revealed?
It's wild,
it's,
right?
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
I ran into my dealer about 6 months in and just on a roundabout. And I was driving all happy in recovery. I was got another, this other, working in a position in an office of all things and with Quicksilver. And I was like, they'd given me a kind of a job for a bit, you know, just to get my kind of active. They were really supportive. And I was just, I'd done a little work at Motorvale, and I was coming round the back way of Warriewood, and this, and I hadn't seen my dealer, right? And I thought I'd kind of forgot about him. I actually had a good, solid distance from him, actually, six months. And it was just me on the road. I'm happily driving along. It's like 11 a.m., beautiful day. And I'm going back to Balgala, where the office was. And I'm driving along and down. It's a T intersection, but it's a roundabout. He comes flying down from the left in his little yellow sort of little hot up car thing, buzzing along, coming down here, like, oh, my God, that's my dealer. And we come in and enter the roundabout. He's coming, turning right, and I'm going straight through from his right, and we meet as he's coming to enter in to go straight out of the exit, and I'm coming to enter the roundabout, and we stop. And he's hanging out the car. He goes, yeah, I'm going, hey, how you going? And you know what happens when you see someone that you haven't seen for a long time, and it doesn't matter who they are, you go straight back to what you were, the last conversation you had with them. All of a sudden the memory in your body comes through and you talk exactly the same. That's why you've got an old friend from school that you haven't seen for years, and all of a sudden, wow, it's just like we were.
My voice changes. I use words I haven't used in 30 years.
Yeah. And all of a sudden I'm in this conversation like I've just done I'm going to do the deal with him.
Wow.
And I'm like looking at him going, he goes, yeah, we're on for this afternoon, you know. And I said, yeah, okay, I'm in. What's your number? Because I threw it away. So I put his new number in my phone. It's one of those Nokia things, you know. And the next minute he goes, yeah, I'll see you this afternoon. I've made the deal. Like, boom. It's going to happen 6 months in, right? And I pull out, go straight through the intersection, and I'm like, I'm sweating. I'm like, look at the phone, and I got his number. And I either save it or I delete it. And something in me didn't allow it to happen, and I deleted it straight away. Looked in the rear vision mirror, the addict trying to save itself, looked at his car, got round the corner flying in the rear vision mirror. He's gone. And do I turn around, right? Do I make the turnaround, try and chase him down? Number's gone. And oh, my God, I'm freaking out now. Oh, my God, I'm breathing so different. Everything's different. And then I just hit the number of my sponsor.
That's the way.
And he was a bricklayer guy, and he was mixing some mud, you know, to bricklayer. He's on the phone. Hey, no, I'm mixing some mud. Just pray like fuck. I'm going, what? I'm like, prayer was like just so distant to me at that point. And so I rang another person in NA, and he answered the phone, and he was available.
Yeah.
And so that connection, I got to talk to him all the way to Balgala about that. And then I went to a meeting that night and I shared it. And that sort of offloaded a whole lot of stuff. But I was that close. I wouldn't be here with you right now.
Dude, thank you so much for sharing that. Because I remember when the guy who took me to my first couple of meetings, I was so freaked out, so paranoid. And people have just met me asking me for my number. I'm like, what do you want my fucking, like, I don't know you. I'm not giving my number. And he kind of said to me, it's like, it's a thing we do. We just share each other's numbers. And I was like, whatever. But anyway, later that year, it was Christmas Eve. And I just got divorced. I'm in that big house all by myself. I'm like, I called 23 people in a day, like people that I'd met at one meeting in New York for 5 minutes. And I've got the number. I just had it saved with a code at the end of it to know that it was a person. It's like, hey, we met once. Have you got 5 minutes? Yeah, I've got 5 minutes.
Isn't that amazing?
23 people. Because I've been taught before I pick up the phone.
Yeah.
Because what are we looking for there? We're looking for connection. And that's what we get.
Yeah.
Isn't
it amazing how wild, right? We want to be there because we know what it's like when that someone calls. You just go, oh, okay. And I'll be in the middle of all sorts of stuff. Family say, hey, I've got to take this call.
And that's like scarier than any hold down story you could have ever told me about, you know, surfing Jaws or something like this.
And I had this thing, just my life in front of me.
Yeah.
It could have
literally at an intersection.
Imagine that. So I'm like, in December, I'll be 17 years. So it would have been, I don't know where, you're just 6 months in. Tom, I just, you know, and I've got these three beautiful daughters and they're doing their thing. You know, the relationship with them would have been so different.
For a lot of people looking at going into, you're getting treatment, the treatment, particularly a residential treatment, that's like, oh, but I can't leave my family. I can't be away. Yours was like over Christmas, like as full on as it gets. Mm. What would you say to people who are, you know, maybe thinking about it, or someone that they love might be thinking about it, about what it is to be away from your family over a period of time for that purpose?
Because it's going to actually help any future that you're going to have, that effect, that ability to actually let go of all the stuff that you're hanging on to, because, again, that's another thing you're hanging on to. If it's been pointing, the fingers have been sort of pointing you in this direction towards going to a facility that's going to help you get well, there's something guiding this happening that's much bigger than you. So try to just go for it, give it all you've got, because it's just going to keep taking, right? It's already taking away. You're on the verge of losing whatever's in front of you anyway. And all the necessary points are coming towards you to make a surrender to the healing that's on offer for you. I think it's fantastic that you can actually allow you get a chance to fall apart. That's the key.
Right.
Falling apart, becoming vulnerable, probably for the first time in your life.
Get a chance to fall apart, because I can relate to, like, it's all so bad, I want it all to stop. And I can definitely understand if you've started to have some thoughts about, well, I've got an idea about how I might make that happen.
Yeah.
Not a good one, I'll tell you right now. But to be able to have some quiet, to have that moment to have a look at it all in a supportive way, and it's particularly depending if how much you've been drinking and using, you're going to need it, because it shits me to tears that, you know, you can do heroin like you're trying to audition for the Rolling Stones and stop. You'll get real sick, but you won't die.
Yeah.
Alcohol and benzos, if you stop cold turkey, if you're using them to a certain point, you'll die.
Yeah.
And you can't. There's a bloke I know who's like doing both. I'm like, bro, you can't just stop.
Yeah.
You know, I know you really want to.
You've got to be,
you've got to be real careful here, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you're supported in that way as well. You're supported health-wise to literally keep you alive.
Yeah.
I'm just so grateful to have a conversation like this, because when I was growing up, there's no way I would have heard two men talking like this.
Yeah.
Fuck no. Never heard it. Certainly not someone like you.
Yeah.
Certainly like someone who's in your position, who's like the peak of athletic prowess, like, you know, this, you know, idolized, like four-page posters folding out with staples in the wrong spot, stuck to a wall of you, right?
Mm.
Talking like this. And I'm... You know, you spoke about meditation earlier. You spoke about, you know, the feeling of surfing and what that gives you now. I mean, I made the joke yesterday that someone asked me, "Was it like when Wolfie was born?" And I said, "Well, the first moment I sniffed his head, what the smell of those pheromones did in my brain, that's what I chased off every single bump I ever did, ever."
Bingo.
Yeah. That feeling was like, oh, this is what I wanted the whole time.
Yeah.
As I'm on my knees in the toilet in King's Cross, you know, with a stranger. It's this.
Yeah. Just want that connection.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the life you have now, could you even describe it to yourself before you stop drinking and using?
Look, the thing is, the beautiful thing that I'm open to today is love. And that's what I feel and sense with people now. It's that could not be done before. That wasn't available to me before. That has grown over the years. And it's funny, on a material point of view, I'm not as wealthy materially, you know. But when I can actually feel love, that's a whole other thing, you know. And actually I can stick by someone. You know, I can be there for someone, you know, close to me. You know, I'm sure, you know, there's some parts of me still that go, oh, God, try to pull away. But I know that part of me, you know, that wants to pull away. And I can step up to challenges today and move toward them rather than away from them, which I could. I mean, you think, riding big, big, challenging waves. And that was part of the feeling, the extreme of feeling connected to something that I needed to get intensity. And that was a part of my condition. I don't need that anymore. It's not a part of the equation anymore. Even though I absolutely love surfing And I love every part of it. I love the ocean. I love the engagement it gives me and the fact that I connect and, you know, I can offer that, you know, I coach kids surfing and the connection I get out of it, the connection, you know, is an expression of love. And I think I can dream that up. No.
So great you came around, man. Thank you so much for sharing what you did today, buddy.
My pleasure, Osha. Good to see you.
Did we do it? You feel like we did it?
I think we're good. Yeah.
That was the incredible Tom Carroll. I have so much love for that man, and I'm so grateful for his wisdom, because far out, man. You don't get to be that wise without having seen the edge of the apocalypse and walked back. I'm grateful he brought some lessons back for the rest of us. Tom Carroll is an absolute legend in or out of the water. His Instagram meditations are just magnificent. You can find him on Instagram, Thomas Victor Carroll, he is. I recommend getting around them. It's pretty good. His book that he wrote with his brother about the journey that he kind of touched on today is fantastic. And if there's something here that Tom or I said that's unlocked a bit of curiosity in you, either for yourself or someone that you know, you can get in touch with South Pacific Private on 1-800-063-332. 1-800-063-332. They're available 7 days a week. There's also a free self-assessment for a number of conditions, southpacificprivate.com.au. Yeah, just go and do it on your phone while you're sitting there on the bus or the train or whatever you're doing. South Pacific Private is Australia's leading treatment centre and has been treating the underlying causes of addiction, anxiety and depression in Australia for over 30 years. And I'm so grateful that they came on board as a sponsor for the show and that they've helped me bring this kind of conversation to you. I can't thank Tom enough for being on the show today. Thank you so much for the team at Acast who lined this whole thing up. Absolutely brilliant. Andy Marr, thank you for doing audio and video post. Abby Benno, who produced this episode and coordinated the whole thing. Toa Hider, who made all the music, get on his Patreon. He's doing 12 episodes in 12 months. Whew. Ben Richardson, my business partner. You, if you're still here, click on the listener survey. It's in the show notes. I'd love to know what you think. I'll be back here on Wednesday.